Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how have animals and our relationships with them changed us and shaped our history? But first,
do violent extremists have common characteristics and backgrounds? Can we predict who among them will become violent? We're joined by Patrick James. He's a researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project.
Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Patrick James. It's great to have you here with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
So you have been studying radicalization. I thought the best place to start is in the U.S., the numbers that we see. How many people are we talking about, and how big are these radical groups?
It's really hard to say how many people exactly in the United States have radicalized. We draw a sample of U.S.-based extremists, and we have the largest database that we know of, and that stands at about 1,500. But we know that's just a small fraction of the amount of people who are active in extremist groups in the United States. I know there are at least tens of thousands of people who are sympathetic to these types of views.
One of the things I read about your study is that something like 43% are in the far right ideological category. Is that right?
That's right. That's what we have in our data. And when we say far right, that's a very broad term for a lot of overlapping movements. So that typically is going to include groups like white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazis, the type of groups that we've seen active recently in places like Charlottesville, but that also includes groups that hold specifically anti-government type ideologies, sovereign citizens, radical militias, anti-immigrant groups. So it's a very broad category that has a lot of overlapping movements. But that is right. About 43% of our data are classified as the far right, and that's the largest category that we have in the data.
You mentioned militia movements, the anti-government, the sovereign citizens, the white nationalists. I guess that would be include the KKK.
That's right.
Who else are you talking about when you say right-wing groups?
Specifically, we're talking about the KKK. They have dozens of chapters around the country. Historically, going back throughout the U.S., the modern sort of far-right movement really has its roots in the 1980s. Groups like the Order specifically targeted well-known Jewish Americans, and they had a few kidnapping plots. And then you really see this large growth of far-right groups, militias. A lot of them are sort of local chapters that aren't bigger than people. And now you really see this sort of coming together of a lot of these groups. They're meeting with each other online, be able to connect with one another, and able to come up and really have a show of force in places like Charlottesville. So it's really varied sort of movement with dozens and dozens of different types of groups.
So would you say, given what you just described to us, that the internet has really been a facilitation tool?
Absolutely. Facilitation, communication tool, and mobilization tool. The internet works to connect these groups instantly. In the past, to have any sort of functional extremist group, you had to, know them face-to-face, be able to have a secure meeting, physical meeting place. Now, in the past decade or so, especially now with social media, these individuals are able to find each other so much easier and form these online communities that sort of act as echo chambers, as meeting places, and places to swap ideas, and in some cases to mobilize in physical space.
When you look across all of the people that are in your database, I saw a quote from one of your colleagues, from Gary LaFrie, who I think heads the program over there. He said in the New York Times that the far right groups are really the most likely to commit violence, like what we saw in Charlottesville. Is there a trend that it's worsening?
It's hard to say if there's a trend. The data that we're going off of right now only goes through 2013, and we're working on updating the data set. And we haven't done any sort of trend analysis on the rates of violence. But what I can say is that he's right in that those on the far right are more likely to engage in violence than those who are motivated by extreme left-wing ideologies, but they're also sort of at the same level in terms of violence with extremists motivated by Islamist ideologies, like those inspired by Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Really, what we see in the data is that the far right and Islamists neck and neck when it comes to likelihood to commit violence, whereas the far left is far more likely to engage in activities that directly harm property, or they engage in vandalism or some sort of industrial sabotage. but they tend to not, in the past couple of decades at least, engage in direct violence themselves.
And then you've also been studying patterns or trying to understand how radicalization actually happens. So let's look at some of those factors. It sounded like, from what I read, it's so varied, it's hard to discern specific factors that are driving the radicalization, but there seem to be tendencies. So can we talk about some of those? One seemed to be ideology among the right wing.
Absolutely. You are right. It's hard to say. If anything that radicalization researchers agree upon, it's that radicalization is complex and that it's a complex process that doesn't unfold in a straight line. It's not linear. But what we can say is that we see across ideologies, so this goes for far right, far left, Islamists, and even those motivated by a single issue, so think like anti-abortion extremists, we see a pattern that those who radicalize in these what we call cliques, so these small insular groups of people, typically 3 to 12 members, when they isolate themselves from the rest of society, and you see these group dynamics kick in, like groupthink and group polarization, those types of people tend to engage in violence more often. We also see that those with some sort of criminal history, and again, this holds across ideologies, those with some sort of criminal history are more likely to engage in violence than those who don't have a criminal history. So we do see these commonalities sometimes across ideologies. In addition to those two factors, we see generally low levels of abuse, being victims of abuse, as well as drug abuse, or those sorts of risk factors that are commonly thought of to lead to radicalization. We don't see a lot of evidence for that. And we also see relatively low levels of mental illness. So I know that's often talked about when we discuss radicalization, sometimes the bridge between mental illness and radicalization to violent extremism is sometimes blurred, and it's a complicated relationship. But the idea that extremists are crazy, that they're all mentally unstable, is something that does not hold out in the data.
Of course, it's hard to know that unless they have a diagnosis. And I can't imagine that it would be easy to know whether or not there has been a diagnosis in these cases. So it's hard to say on that.
Yeah, one of the challenges we have with the data is that we are reliant on open source material. So sometimes it is difficult to come across concrete diagnoses of mental illness. You're absolutely right.
So the other things I found interesting were demographics, commonalities, like people had traditionally thought that people who fall into these extremist groups tend to be poor, but that turns out to not be the case at all.
That's right. When we look at the socioeconomic background of extremists across the entire sample, the biggest group come from middle-class backgrounds. There is some slight variation. So those on the far right are less likely to achieve higher levels of education. For instance, only 25% of far-right extremists attained a college degree compared to 43% for the rest of the sample. And they're also less likely to come from a high level of socioeconomic background. That being said, middle-class background is still the most common thing. In terms of demographics, we find that there are some differences across the far right and the far left in Islamists. Far right extremists tend to be older, so an average age of 36 by the time they kind of come to public awareness, usually by their arrest, compared to 31 years of age for the entire sample. And they're also more likely to be male. 95% of the far right in our sample are male, compared to about 89 to 90% for the rest of the sample. We see the majority for every category of sort of ideological milieu is overwhelmingly male. The highest percentage of females we see is in the far left. About a quarter of the far left are females.
In terms of the radicalization mechanisms, you noted personal psychology and collective psychology. Just a little while ago when we were talking, you said, of course, there's things like groupthink and conformity. How does that all work out?
It's a complex process. The philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that from the crooked timbers of humanity, never a straight thing was made. And that really holds up when we think about radicalization and how it works at the individual level. So it's possible for us to draw these broad comparisons across ideologies. Looking at it and digging into it at the individual level, the process itself is difficult. But with some of the research we've done, using some methodologies that can handle this sort of idea of complexity, we can begin thinking of radicalization in terms of multiple pathways. And we found a number of conditions that really set the stage for active violent extremism. The first condition is one we call cognitive frame alignment. And that means a person undergoes some sort of fundamental shift in the way they come to view the world. And perhaps more importantly, how they actually handle new information that they encounter, which runs against their belief system. So it kind of provides an environment for radicalization to take place, this sort of mental shift that disallows the person to think critically of incoming information. The second and probably more important condition, and I think more interesting one, is that we find when a person develops what we call a sense of a community crisis, it seems to be hugely important for whether or not they engage in violence. A community crisis is when they come to closely align or identify with a group that they consider to be under some sort of existential threat by a hostile external group. And we see this across ideologies. So for the far right, that's often manifested in terms of the federal government, which a lot of them see as run by some sort of conspiratorial Jewish shadow government. Or we also see it, for instance, in a lot of Islamist and Al-Qaeda type narratives where they see Muslims around the world being under threat from a hostile Western power. When people identify with the group that they see to be under threat, that seems to be one of the most important things that actually leads to violent mobilization.
Well, that would make sense. And given the media messages that some of their websites and even some of the more mainstream right wing put forward, it really starts to make logical sense that if they really believe that, they would be afraid and concerned and believe there's really an existential threat.
Absolutely. And a lot of these sites do a really good job at sort of packaging a narrative and selling it. They typically don't start out, you know, giving them the entire sort of narrative all at once. Usually it's a slow process that, you know, it's an incremental step process. But once you become fully committed to the ideology, it's a really compelling argument that, you know, for instance, for white supremacists, that the white race is being under a constant state of threat from a hostile federal government and hostile minorities who are trying to take some sort of position of privilege away from them. It becomes a really powerful motivating factor for a lot of these people.
And I imagine with the current president in the U.S. administration legitimizing these beliefs, it seems to make even more sense.
Absolutely. We've seen, I think, an uptick in hate crime incidents. I know the Southern Poverty Law Center, they do a great job at tracking instances of hate crimes over time. And I believe they've seen a huge uptick since the current administration has taken over. But when you see that sort of rhetoric and that sort of messaging coming from the very top, it certainly doesn't help the situation any.
Finally, one of the things I thought were really interesting is that families don't really matter that much.
Yeah, we found that family members tend not to have a huge influence on whether or not someone's likely to be violent. We find that peers seem to really be the deciding factor of whether or not someone is going to behave violently or non-violently. However, families, I do think they play a big role when we think about intervention and prevention programs. People who are closest to an individual that's going on some sort of extremist path are going to be the ones who see them every day. And that's going to be their family members, sometimes their close friends. So there has to be some sort of space right now for family members who, you know, concerned mothers and fathers and siblings and other people close to the person. There has to be some sort of space for them to go to, be able to help the person, be able to get the resources they need to get the person onto some sort of off-ramp. And we see from all sorts of research looking at de-radicalization that the influence of the close family is very important to bringing people out of extremist groups.
So it doesn't bring them in as much as it does help to get them out.
I think that's where the research is pointing at this point, yeah.
Well, Patrick James, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick James, he's a researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project.
When we come back, how have animals and our relationships with them changed us and shaped our history? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Human history has been drastically changed by our relationship with animals, so much so that our next guest says it would have been a radically different world if not for animals in our intimate bonds with them. How have they changed us in the world we live in? With us is Brian Fagan. He's a professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of more than 24 books, including the latest, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Brian Fagan. It's great to have you back here with us.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
So another fascinating book. This time you've looked at how animals have shaped human history in your latest book, The Intimate Bond. And your argument is basically that non-human animals have essentially contributed to what we've become, and that in some ways these relationships are more important than the buildings and artistic masterpieces. How so?
We really have a preoccupation, or have had a preoccupation in the past, with the domestication of animals. Dogs, goats, sheep, cattle, donkeys, camels, whatever. Which is fine and very important. But what has been ignored is the enormous contribution, the ongoing contribution that animals made to human history, which in many respects are just as significant, as important, and as the rise and fall of civilizations. It's a very, very important part of the picture.
Now, you've also said that this is sort of intangible. So how do we know the history of the relationships and their effects?
It's a very complex story built up from a very broad-ranging way of sources. You can't simply dig up a bone and say, this is a cow. It's much more complicated than that. And this story involves sources of all kinds. It involves animal bones, which now, the study of which has become highly sophisticated and very detailed. And for example, with fish now, we can tell the weight and length of fish from fish bones, which is amazing. We know a lot about now animal diets and things like that. So that's a whole set of variables, and research in high-tech science based on animals themselves, on the bones. Then you've got, and this people forget, is the context of the bones when found in the ground. You may find a donkey, as they did in Egypt from 4000 BC, buried in a grave with considerable ceremony. What does this mean? What role did this donkey have in history? And when we look closely at it, we find that its bones show signs of pathological wear, as if it had been a load carrier. But it was clearly a prestigious load carrier owned by a wealthy person. So that's another way we look at it. Then we look at historical records. There are, for example, fascinating historical records in that wedge-shaped script called cuneiform on clay tablets from a site called Kultepe in central Turkey, which document donkey trade between what is now northern Iraq and central Turkey in textiles and gold for several hundred years in the second millennium BC. And those records tell us about the prices, about the value of the donkeys, about the journeys, the length of the journeys, the size of the caravans, the correspondence between merchants at one end and the other, even wives complaining about prices not being paid and so on. It really is an insight into the past. Then you've got an enormous reservoir of information, which archaeologists tend not to read, about animal behavior. For example, we know a great deal about ranch cattle, which has a great bearing on the way in which cattle herders have treated their herds over the centuries. And then, of course, you've got Victorian records, government records, private records of societies dedicated to preventing cruelty to animals and all that. So the record is straddles dozens of different academic disciplines and all kinds of topics. For example, if you take cats, everyone says, why did one not do more on cats? The answer is that cats are what they call commensal animals. They live with us, although they're domesticated. And their role from the beginning was prized as rodents, really, rodent controllers before they became pets in Egypt. and so on and so forth. It's a very complicated story full of lovely tangents.
You went back something like 2.5 million years is where it looks like it began, and there have been major transformations in our relationships with other animals. If you could identify what the most profound transformations are over this time, what would you say they are?
The first, and really the history of animals from the modern sense, goes back into the late Ice Age to 30 or even longer ago, when people hunted animals and had great respect for them. And the relationship, which we can document from the famous Cro-Magnon cave paintings of France, are really very, very telling and can be related to modern hunters' attitudes to animals, where they respected the animals they hunted, they believed they had supernatural qualities, and so forth. That relationship is one of respect and mutual living together. The most profound change, apart from the domestication of the dog, which really was more initially, I think, as a companion and a guard dog more than anything else, when your real catalyst for change, the first one, was the domestication of farm animals, pigs, goats, sheep, cattle. That was huge. That was, 10,000, 9,000, 8,000 BC. They were domesticated in all sorts of places. And other animals were domesticated, like water buffalo in Asia and so on. And then you've got another real turning point, which was the domestication of pack animals, of which the most important by far was the donkey. The donkey was the pickup of the ancient world. I mean, it really joined civilizations and semi-arid lands. It's a remarkable animal. And that happened about 4,000 BC. And then after that, later, you got the camel and the horse domesticated. And those two, of course, transformed history. The camel conquered deserts and the Silk Road, and the horse, of course, became an instrument of war, and the relationship between people and horses, as you know, is very, very complex. So there have been all these stages. And then, of course, the final one is the Industrial Revolution, the industrialization of civilization, the plight of urban animals, and in the 19th century, the huge surge in the keeping of domestic pets, which really was the foundation for a lot of the animal anti-cruelty societies of the 19th century. So you've got all these stages, but really it's a continual story which raises a question. What is our relationship with animals? Are they our servants? Are they our companions? Are they our partners? Or are they a little bit of all of that? And that's a question that we really, as human beings, haven't yet quite worked out.
Well, let's go into some of the details of these individual animals and how they've contributed to human history and vice versa, as well as some of these other aspects that you mentioned now. Like, you talked about how animals were respected and in some cases revered, even in the very, very early days of humanity, including living with them. And in your book, you also mentioned they knew them all individually. That's changed with some animals, but not others. What happened?
Oh, this very much refers to some animals and not others. I think what I really dwelt on it in the book was when I was talking about the domestication of the dog. And, of course, the dog's wild ancestor was the wolf. And wolves are very social animals. They live in packs. And, like humans, they tracked animals. And they watched animals constantly. One of the most striking things about hunters, traditional hunters, is the amount of time they spent stalking, tracking, and just watching animals. And in individual herds, they would know these herds really well. They know the young animals. They would know the increasingly female adults. They would know the age of the animals by looking at the color of their skins. And wolves must have had a similar, very intimate knowledge of their prey, but they obviously focused on the older, more disabled, or the young animals, and they would track and live alongside herds most of the time, and humans did the same. And there is little question that our very close relationship as hunters with animals was based on very close observation. It was based on a kind of cosmic view of the world that we were in the world accompanied by supernatural forces, which included mythic beasts. And living animals were the living personification of many of these supernatural animals. And if you look at cave paintings in France, very often you'll see a human imprint on the wall where they've blown powder against their hands, and the imprint is there. And it is thought that that was people, and there were ethnographic analogies of this, people drawing power from the powerful supernatural forces of the animals painted on the wall, which lurked behind the rock. And you've got a lot of evidence from, for example, Inuit, that they always hunt with respect, they dispose of bones they don't eat, and so on. And it clearly is a relationship which was almost a partnership, not one where everyone lived happily ever after, but it was a partnership, and it was a partnership of respect because people depended on the animals. But then when you got to dogs and the domestication of dogs, it's clear that this happened in many places. Quite when it happened, we don't know, probably, certainly by 15,000 years ago in Europe, Eurasia, and probably the Near East. And it clearly was a matter of propinquity, where you had wolf bands who were well known to the people who lived alongside them and watched them. They knew individual animals by sight, and you can be sure that some of the animals knew the humans by sight. And, I mean, I've walked among herds in Africa when I was young, and very often you'd see the same animals, and you got to recognize them. So this relationship is intimate. And when you've got sociable animals like wolves and sociable people like humans, and both are scavengers, you can imagine scenarios where neither was really afraid of the other, because contrary to popular belief, wolves aren't particularly fearsome. They're rather timid, and they're very social. And it may be that the first domestication of dogs took place as a result of this close relationship, and maybe somebody captured some cubs or something like that, and the cubs became dependent on the humans and so on and so forth, and became companions and maybe even hunting dogs. We don't know. But that seems to have been the first relationship long before domesticated farm animals.
So the DNA of dogs is very similar to that of wolves.
The DNA of dogs and wolves is very similar. And the whole study of the DNA of humans and animals is still very much at an early stage. But it seems that there are changes gradually happening. But for a long time, a lot of the DNA of wolves, wild wolves, was still in dogs, and it persisted for a long time. This is an area which has got very complex, and much of it, again, is focused on where did the first dogs emerge, and the only thing that really came out of it is they were domesticated in several places.
Now, you also mentioned that historically animals were symbols of status, and that has seems to have changed over time.
It has, and it hasn't, actually, if you look at it closely, because what you've got is, on the one hand, a huge tradition which goes back thousands of years of rulers being fierce lions and great warriors, because the lion is seen as fierce. You've got bulls with powerful, virile animals who again became symbols of power in ancient Crete. You've got human dog gods who became bulls and emerged from the ocean. And you've got a real issue, and that is, if you're going to hunt something like the aurochs, the formidable, now extinct, wild ox, which was quite a beast with lyre-shaped horns, which when provoked was extremely fierce and dangerous. If you can hunt those with only a spear or bow and arrow, you've A, got skill, and B, got courage. And a lot of the prestige surrounding animals does go back to hunting and leadership and fierceness and leadership in war. But then you've got another type of status, which is less conspicuous but terribly important, and that is the one of owning animals. If you look at cattle herders or any people who have herds, the number of animals you have is an important part of your life. It's important because it gives you surplus male animals, which you can use to throw feasts, to pay bride price, and for other purposes like that, to bring people into your orbit. And then you've got, in later times, the value of cattle as plow animals, and you've got the value of cattle as draft animals, and so on and so forth. And with donkeys, you had the same thing in Egypt. It was a very valuable possession to have a donkey. And if you had a caravan of 200 donkeys and you were going part of the way across the Sahara, you had clout, you had money, you had people who looked after the animals and went with them, and the loads were enormously valuable. The profit from it was enormous, and this gave you power and prestige. And then, of course, you get into the whole thing with the Romans of horses and great emperors mounted on horses and the symbol of power this represents. You've got the symbol of the knight in armor, of cavalry, of Genghis Khan, all these symbols of power. There's always been a very powerful aura of power among many animals, among them, of course, eagles.
Then the other aspect that you noted in the book, but we haven't really talked much about, is this religion, spiritual role. How has that been manifested historically, and what has it become today?
It really goes back, and if you read your Homer, I was terribly lucky as a high school kid. I had a teacher for a couple of years who absolutely loved Homer, and he gave me a lifelong love of Homer. And if you look at Homer's poems, which of course date to the first millennium BC, and are really poems that were recited by bards at feasts and on special occasions, they time and time again dwell on the power of the bull, the sacrifice of the bull, the symbol of the bull for leadership and power, the association of bulls with the gods, and above all, with virility and the continuity of life. Bulls were enormously important, and they were enormously important, for example, in classical Athens, where there was an ambivalence about them. On the one hand, you kept them and sacrificed them. On the other hand, you ate the meat. And this was a complex business connected with the role of sacrifice in both in Greek and Roman society, where the protocols were very strict and involved animals. Today, I don't think really there are any people who worship bulls or treat them or any animals with particular divine sanction, although, of course, you get in Christianity the Lamb of God and things like that, but these are more symbolic things. That's really a product of a world where one was much closer to one's animals and where animals were wealth and power in a way they really aren't now.
One of the main ways it seems that animals have shaped human history has been the transportation aspect. You focused on donkeys, on camels, on horses, and how much they've contributed to human history development. And a lot of this was around transportation.
Oh, indeed. Contemplate a world which existed, for example, among the Aztecs in Mexico, where the only methods of transportation were on water with rafts and canoes, or on people's backs, which provides an immediate limitation, A, to the amount you can travel in a day and the amount you can carry. So the domestication of pack animals was enormously important. It was important in the sense that it was a way of transporting goods and people. And people really underestimate the scale of the caravan trade in, say, the 15th, 16th century, across the Sahara, across the entire Middle East, deep into Asia, the Silk Route, and so on. This was a huge, very complex enterprise, which involved tens of thousands of people and animals. There were still a few camel caravans in the Sahara that carry salt, although they're gradually dying out in the face of the diesel truck with four-wheel drive. But there are some. And people don't realize that the relationship between the human being who led the camels and the beast was very close. The beast carried the goods. The humans led them from one waterhole to the next. And this relationship was almost kind of symbiosis where the two lived together. Very, very complex. And there's a marvelous account by a writer from the 1920s who went on a caravan in Mongolia and observed how these caravan pullers, they were called, navigated landmarks that you and I just wouldn't even think of, leading their camels to water and to grazing. Very complex. But the thing that really helped the camel wasn't domestication of the camel. That was done in Saudi Arabia. It was the design of the saddle. And there's a marvelous monograph on camel saddles, which points out that the earliest saddles were just kind of at the back end of the camel, where you kind of clung on. But it wasn't until they mastered the art of sitting high on the camel that people could fight from a camel or could carry loads in side panniers. And that's what really opened up the desert. But the animal that really is unheralded and neglected, and it's very interesting that with this book, the most powerful reaction to it has been to my emphasis on donkeys, is the humble donkey. It has some enormous advantages. It moves faster than a camel. It is extremely adaptable to semi-arid and arid terrain, will eat practically anything, and is relatively easy to train. They're also small, and they're also relatively cheap, and can be caravaned very effectively. In the early days, clearly, like the burial in Egypt I talked about, clearly they were very valuable. But later in Egyptian history, there were people who had 1,000 donkeys. And when you come to about 1100 BC, in that time, with this trade in gold and textiles between Assyria, which was then what northern Iraq was called, and central Turkey, the trade was so lucrative that the Assyrians maintained a colony in Kultepe. And it's the records of this colony which has told us so much about this. And the price of a donkey in Assyria at the east end of the route and in Kultepe at the west end of the route was exactly the same. These animals had no value at all as a merchandisable commodity. They were purely a commodity for carrying loads who were worked to death. And it's no coincidence that, for example, a mule, which is, of course, a cross of a horse and donkey, was one of the primary transportation modes of Roman armies. Donkeys were a primary part of Greek farming. And all of this took place below the historical radar. They were the pickup trucks that you see on the roads that nobody ever talks about. They carried loads. They connected civilizations. They carried people, and did so despite wars and pharaohs coming and going and all that. They were a terribly fundamental commodity, and I stress the word commodity. There may have been an animal. They may have had personalities. Some of them may have been better than others, but ultimately they became a commodity. And the biggest change in our relationship with animals is the moment when they really started becoming commodities.
One of the things about the donkey is that you saw it as so important that you essentially attributed globalization to the donkey.
Oh yes, definitely. Because if you look at Egypt, you look at Mesopotamia, you look at other civilizations, you've got deserts and semi-arid lands. And in many of these places, there are no waterways. And the donkey connected these seemingly isolated rivers like the Euphrates and Tigris with the Mediterranean. They linked the Tigris to central Turkey. And the ancient Egyptians, and this is some really remarkable research done by German archaeologists, the Egyptians, 3,000 years ago or more, were running large donkey caravans 200 miles into the Sahara to collect semi-precious stones from oases. And the research on these routes, which are very dry, is so thorough that they found the tracks, they found the droppings of the donkeys, they found the skeletons of donkeys that died, and they found caches of the clay pots in which the caravan carried water for humans and animals, as well as food and the resting places. And it's clear that something like a third of the donkeys carried water, a third carried food, and a third carried the actual commodity which you were transporting. And this would never have been possible in some of the driest terrain in Earth if it hadn't been for the versatility of the donkey. They're grossly underrated.
Let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're speaking with Brian Fagan about his latest book, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. I'd like to turn to the horse, because so much of our shape of our countries and our empires have been influenced by the domestication of the horse. Let's talk about the history there. If not for the horse, how would our world look different?
It would look very different. The thing about a horse, and this is something that often isn't little known, the horse was domesticated north of the Black Sea. Quite when, nobody knows. And quite when it was first ridden isn't known. Probably 4,000 BC, around there. But the thing about a horse is once you start riding it, you develop a very close relationship with your horse, because horses operate on a basis of feel and confidence, and they're steered by a rider who knows them. But the thing it really does is annihilate distance. And distance, when you have cattle or donkeys, is one thing. But when you have horses who gallop on open terrain, you can control herds over enormous distances. And as the Mongols learned, and Genghis Khan, of course, is the classic example, got organized and organized the famous Mongolian hordes, which actually were highly trained light cavalry, they really quickly mastered an enormous tract of Eurasia, part of China, and of course penetrated as far west as Hungary, where they annihilated medieval knights in suits of armor on their cart horses. And what saved Europe was the fact that Genghis Khan died and the general who was penetrating Europe was recalled for the election of the new Khan. But it really changed history. And then you've got, on top of that, the move south into Mesopotamia, the development of chariots. And one of the most marvelous things which I came across was there was a manual of cavalry horse training written by a man called Kekuli on some clay tablets in about 1000 BC, which really lays out a very strict routine. But it stresses that you must be kind yet firm to your horses. And this was so effective that it was used for centuries. And an Australian rider has actually tried the training system and found it works surprisingly well. And the basic principles of cavalry training were passed down right to the Crimean War. And in the Crimean War in the 1850s, there was a English cavalry officer called Louis Nolan. He wasn't very senior, but he was an incredibly gifted horseman. And he wrote a book about the training of cavalry horses. And the whole message was kindness, sensitivity, firmness, and so on. So a lot of the knowledge is very, very old. But the horse acquired prestige for leaders. It became a powerful shock weapon, although the Romans only used them as scouts. And of course, the height of insanity was in the 19th century, culminating in the idiotic charge of the Life Brigade under Lord Carnarvon. And, Lord Cardigan, of course. Anyway, the charge, which basically charged a battery of Russian guns and half the horses and people were killed. But, of course, what really killed off cavalry was the machine gun, the Civil War in this country, and then, of course, the Great War. Although horsemen were still used by the Russians in War II, and the Russians deliberately called them Cossacks because Cossacks, being Mongols, terrified German soldiers. So there is a long, long history with horse.
The book primarily looks at eight animal species as these primary relationships that have shaped human history. If you had close runners-up, what would they be?
The llama, of course, in South America, which I don't really cover. The llama has limitations in terms of the amount it can carry, but the Inca used them extensively in caravans between the lowlands and highlands and the Andes. That's a terribly important animal. The chicken is a very important animal, which I didn't bring up in the book. Somebody, a guy called Andrew Lawler, actually, has just written a marvelous book on chickens, where he points out that they're terribly important. Turkeys in this country were a huge staple in many Native American societies, and the list goes on and on. The one that reviewers have told me I should have spent more time on, as I said earlier, was cats. But I'm unrepentant because cats, really, important as they are to us, are really a sideline in history. And, of course, were associated with black magic in the Middle Ages. So I kept them on the side.
You did keep them on the side, but you did write about them. They didn't get a whole chapter or anything. You mentioned the oldest domestication in Cyprus, and you mentioned their supernatural association in Egypt. So they had a special place.
Oh, indeed. And I am sitting at my desk, and sitting with me is my Maine coon cat. I think what he wants is his dinner, but he is looking at me very, very spiritually. Yes, they have huge presence. They have huge presence. We have three cats. But they have been, you know, animals of mystery and so on. They are my favorite beast.
Have elephants had an important role?
Oh, yeah. The elephants, of course, Hannibal, and they were used as war elephants. They acquired enormous prestige in India as Maharajas' mounts. Well, again, they were used for war horses, as load carriers. Oh, yeah, very important.
Toward the end of your book, where you talk about the changes in terms of, you know, cruelty to animals, protection to animals, and how that has evolved and where we're going as a society, in essence. So starting with this idea that cruelty to farm animals was not particularly new, and this, you noted, was particularly true among the British. But then we also had the development of protection for animals. So give us a little history there first.
The real concern with cruelty to animals really arose, I think, as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution with rapid urbanization, because then much of the cruelty to craft animals, for example, really came into city streets where people could see it at close hand. And from this developed the first legislation, which was designed to protect the conditions of working animals. And this resulted in some fairly ineffective legislation, but also in the formation of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which today is still a very vibrant, powerful organization, which documented cases and took people to court and wrote very powerful reports. And this gradually extended its mandate from basically working animals into pets, because the other big thing that happened, and the people who really were the impetus behind a lot of the animal cruelty societies, were a huge emerging middle class who developed an absolutely passionate devotion to pet dogs, cats, birds, rabbits, you name them. And our current huge pet industry has very firm roots in the Victorian middle class and the rise of animal keeping. But at the same time, cities were literally menageries of animals of all kinds, chickens kept for food, pigs, sheep, everything. It was filthy. But the domestic pampered pet really became the figurehead of anti-cruelty movements, which in recent years, of course, have moved far more into things like industrial-grade farming and penning of animals and so on. And that's where a lot of the effort goes these days. But having said all that, there is still a great deal of cruelty to animals. You read about it in the paper every day. You shudder. And a lot of it is just plain ignorance by people about what animals are like. My wife is a rabbit expert, and we keep rabbits, and we work with a local shelter, and we keep on hearing appalling stories of how people look after their rabbits. But they really are lovely animals, and it's, in a way, you've got to have a commitment to look after animals. And one of the great dilemmas of contemporary society is this whole issue of our relationship with animals. How do we treat them? How human are animals? And this, of course, on the more extreme manifestations, is reflected in the animal rights movements and so on. And the fact of the matter is we have a huge dilemma, because on the one hand, we eat animals, we slaughter them, produce them on an industrial scale to eat. On the other hand, we cherish and love them. It's no coincidence that many children's books are about animals. So one really doesn't know where this is going. I don't think anybody knows. The fact that I think we understand animals better now than we used to is very important, but there were no easy solutions.
It seems like from your last chapter, which looks over some of these efforts legislatively, beginning with a bill in 1800 in the House of Commons, and then the Irish parliamentarian Colonel Richard Martin, who campaigned against bear baiting and dog fighting.
Yep.
It seems like through time there has been certain specific acts made to be symbols of a humanity that we don't want to be, like barbaric. But that is still very species-specific and very act-specific. And how do you see that changing now?
If you go back to the 19th century, you have this huge, I suppose it was a cult, of big game hunters and their exhibits and their stuffed animals and so on. And there has been a huge revulsion against that, to the point now that big game hunting, which has huge status, has become basically, as we saw with the tragic thing of Cecil the Lion, a carefully managed enterprise for those who want to spend a lot of money. It's not a joke. It's sick, in my judgment. But that's one end of the spectrum. The other side of the spectrum is we have a huge, very vigorous hunting culture in this society, which covers everything from waterfowl to deer, much of it done in the market in the name of culling, and some of it is very well handled. But this notion that we hunt animals is very, very deeply ingrained in our psyche. We are, after all, coming off hundreds of thousands of years of being hunters and foragers. It's the same with fish. I mean, if you look at fishing, we're overfishing the ocean because we seem to think that we have mastery of the ocean. We don't.
I wonder if this attitude might start to change normatively as we evolve as a humanity.
I think there are a number of very intricate variables involved here. One is changing feelings about animals. The second one is the enormous numbers of people who have pets. But the third one, which is the silent elephant in the room, is that of population. And if you look at fishing, for example, fishing compared with 150 years ago is now an industrial pursuit. We are scouring the ocean. A staggering proportion of the fish eaten in China, I believe it's something like 75%, is farmed. And in a way, we are confronting a world where there aren't going to be enough animals for everyone to eat. And I don't know where that's going, because in a way, we are at a moment of truth where there were so many of us. And a lot of the values we've had in a world with many fewer people are going to be torpedoed just by the sheer pressure of people. And I think the pressures to eat more vegetable foods are going to be enormous. And I think this will be something that may change a lot of what we do. But I'm guessing. This isn't my field.
Two last questions that I wonder if we can draw from. One was, you noted that Britain had been known for being particularly cruel to its animals, but then it became sort of a world leader in animal protection. I wonder
yep.
if we can learn anything from that evolution and in comparison to its neighbors.
The cruelty really stemmed from the Industrial Revolution, and the reaction against it very largely came from an increasingly better educated middle class who loved animals, many of whom were urban, who are divorced from the world of the farm. And I think a great deal of the movements towards more humane treatment of animals, in fact, come from urban populations who are not familiar with the realities of the countryside, although the treatment of animals on farms is much better now than it used to be. So you've got a lot of forces all coming together. And the English have a long tradition of loving pets. They are known as, in certain circles, as the great British pet-loving public, and there's a lot of truth in that. And this has spread to other parts of the world. I would say in Western civilization now, the treatment of pets is really good, and I think this is spilling over into working animals. And the world is getting so much more mechanized now. I mean, when you realize that in Chicago in the late 19th century there were 200,000 horses in the city and many fewer people than there are today, it gives you some idea of the scale of the horse industry at the time. Enormous. Now it's motor cars and trucks.
The final thing I wanted to look at was you mentioned the vexing questions raised by the ethicist Peter Singer. why we protect some animals more than others. What does your research suggest is an answer to that question?
You're dealing with very deeply ingrained values. For example, I spent some of my early career in Africa, and in an area where there were large numbers of extremely lethal snakes, and one's attitude to snakes. And when you went to dinners, people always talked about snakes. Snake stories were favorite stories. But the general litany was, you see a snake, you kill it on sight. And skunks are another one. Raccoons are another one aren't particularly fond of. And there are animals that have these reputations. Like the wolf, in many people think is a hungry, angry predator. It's actually quite a timid beast. And I think a lot of this is stereotypes. And one of the things I think one has to do is educate people about animals in much more detail than we've ever done.
Brian Fagan, thank you so much for being with us once more on the Scholar Circle. Brian Fagan is a professor emeritus of archaeology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the author of more than 24 books, including the latest, The Intimate Bond, How Animals Have Shaped Human History. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history, and certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions.
Angela Davis, African American civil rights activist, author, and professor of the history of consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Poet Sylvia Plath with excerpts from a 1962 radio interview.
These peculiar, private, and taboo subjects, I feel, have been explored in recent American poetry. I think particularly of the poetess Anne Sexton, who writes also about her experiences as a mother who's had a nervous breakdown, as an extremely emotional and feeling young woman. And her poems are wonderfully craftsmanlike poems, and yet they have a kind of emotional and psychological depth, which I think is something perhaps quite new, quite exciting.
Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982.
For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.